Our seventh case this morning is United States versus Veras. Good morning, Mr. Gansner.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Anderson Gansner, and I represent the appellant in this case, Dailey Veras. The facts of a case matter, and at a criminal sentencing, certain facts are exceptionally important. For instance, in a narcotics case, the amount of drugs, in a robbery, the amount of money taken, and in a fraud case like this, how long the fraud went on. But the judge below got that fact unmistakably wrong. The offense went on for 18 months. He thought it went on for 4 years. And we know this because he said so when he was emphasizing the seriousness of the offense and declaring that Mr. Veras had no respect for the law, despite Mr. Veras' otherwise spotless record, his confession, and his efforts to assist the government.
What about his saying, "I stand corrected," after your client corrected him about the length of time?
Well, I corrected him about the length of time.
Well,
and what he said was, "I stand corrected," which I think I view as a clear admission that he had gotten it wrong. If he had wanted, if he had misunderstood it, as the government suggests, so he just misspoke. If he had done that, that was the prime opportunity to say so. Say, I understood the facts, I simply misspoke. Instead, by saying, "I stand corrected," a correction occurs when you've gotten something wrong and you have to make a change. So he is essentially admitting that he got the fact wrong and misunderstood it.
Well, whether he misspoke or got the fact wrong, for you to succeed in this argument, you have to show that he based the sentence on that misunderstanding. And there were other reasons why, you know, that he identified for the length of the sentence that he gave your client.
That's true, but they all turned around the severity of the offense. It all turned around, you know, the amount of money, the number of victims, and again, how long it went on. And he repeated, this wasn't a one-time occurrence. This happened again and again. And when he mentioned the length of the offense, he was talking about a 3553A factor in particular. He was talking about the need to promote respect for the law and whether Mr. Veras had demonstrated respect for the law. And he said, listen, that totally destroys any belief that you might have some respect for the law, given how long this went on. And the other cases where courts have made some mistakes and that the government points to, in those instances, the courts were told or knew or learned or realized that an error had been made before the sentence had been imposed. And that's really one of the key differences here is the judge was in the midst of, you know, this fiery admonishment of my client. He said 4 years, and the first opportunity we had to talk to him about that was after the sentence had been imposed. The sentence of imprisonment put it out there, the sentence of supervised release, and even the supervised release terms. Effectively, the sentencing was pretty much over. All we really talked about after that point was, you know, recommendation about where he'd be incarcerated. So if you read the transcript, the judge, it's in the middle of that portion where the judge is emphasizing how severe the offense is. And as the government notes in its own brief, that's really what drove the sentence. So this makes this case exactly like what the court talks about in the Miller case, where it said a single misinformed comment warrants resentencing if it reveals that the judge misapprehended the record with respect to an aggravating factor that the judge considered important. And in any fraud case, how long the offense went on, how many, you know, transactions there were, how many trips in this case, how many back and forths there were, how much time you had to stop doing what you were doing, that is clearly an aggravating factor. And the more it goes on, the more important it is.
Well, you're more concerned with the length of the sentence you were comparing to others. Is that correct?
When with regard to the second issue, Your Honor?
Well, if that's what you want to call it, the second issue, that's what I'm looking at. I don't remember the exact numbers, but there were three numbers, mm-hmm. and his was sort of in the middle.
Yeah, so I...
And that's sort of where his sentence was, I thought.
And the deal with that argument, Your Honor, is, you know, if the court didn't agree, if the court rejected it and didn't buy and thought our client, you know, fell in place, that's, you know, that's the court's call to make. We're making the arguments to the district judge. It's up to him to decide how persuasive he finds them. But the error there is that both us and the government were both relying on those three other cases. Our argument was that our client's conduct was much less severe than those other three people who all ran their own schemes, who all committed these offenses for much longer periods of time, were all in the country illegally, And Mr. Veras, on the other hand, just did sort of a portion of the scheme, kept a much smaller percentage of the money, and the scheme went on for a much shorter period of time. So our argument was, listen, he really pales in comparison to these other defendants. And the government sort of viewed it a different way. The government said, no, Mr. Veras kind of falls in line with our view and, you know, where his sentence should be.
Go ahead. You also have this issue of the mandatory consecutive.
Yes.
The 24 months, I think, was, wasn't it?
That's right, on the 1028A charge. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
So not much you can do about that.
Right. That part of the sentence was set in stone. There wasn't anything we could do about it. That's right.
Okay.
And two of the defendants we were talking about had also been convicted of 1028A charges. So their sentence is probably the fairest comparison, because it was thinking of that charge and in addition to the fraud charges that were tacked on top of them. And our argument was one of those defendants, for example, got a 15-month sentence on top of his 24-month mandatory minimum. And Mr. Veras, of course, got a 28-month sentence. And our view was that Mr. Veras was much less culpable, had a much, you know, did much less in terms of his offense. And we noted that and argued that to the judge. And since the government was using that same argument, and we were also talking about a guideline that, you know, isn't followed very often, it's followed less than half the time, and the government was relying on those same comparisons, all we're simply arguing here is that the judge should have at least mentioned the issue, should have said, okay, you know, I don't really buy these comparisons, or, you know, I don't find them persuasive, or I believe, you know, I think the government has the better argument with regard to these issues. But the judge didn't say anything about it at all.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I just want to make sure I've got the record right.
Yes.
So in this 4 years comment, what the district court said was you victimized 500 individuals over 4 years.
Yes.
Is the number of individuals correct?
Yes, it was. So the judge did get other facts right. He got the amount of money right. He got the number of victims roughly right. But he got the length of the offense wrong. And then he kind of reemphasized that again. He said this, you know, this wasn't a one-time occurrence. So clearly to him, it was an aggravating factor.
Well, 500 individuals isn't a one-time occurrence.
Of course.
You know, 499 more than once.
Yes, of course. Although the way Mr. Veras would do it is he would get stacks of these, you know, fake refund checks, ship them or bring them to Milwaukee, have them cashed at this particular check cashing business that was, you know, obviously sort of a hotbed for this kind of activity, and then bring the money back. And so what we're talking about is just more trips, right? More time, more maybe in smaller amounts, but more trips and over an extended period of time where, you know, my client, if it had been 4 years, you know, every day he should have known that he should have stopped. Every day he's engaging in more transactions, he's doing more of the same thing, and he's putting himself in deeper and deeper. And I would submit that 18 months is dramatically less than 48 months. It's the equivalent, I was thinking of it, it's the equivalent of robbing 3 banks versus robbing 8 banks. That's a significant difference. Well, and the judge clearly relied on it.
It is, because it's the same number of people. That's I think, you just did a lot more in a short period of time.
I agree. It's sort of reducing the scale, but, you know, increasing the frequency. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you want to save your time?
Yes, I will, unless the court has any more questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Tableson.
May it please the court, Rebecca Tableson on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, Daley Veras was, as the district court found, the linchpin of an extensive fraud scheme that caused over $2.7 million in losses. For that crime, he received a below-guideline sentence that was in line with sentences imposed on similar defendants. His appeal focuses on two quibbles with the judge's sentencing remarks. First, Mr. Veras attempts to characterize a fleeting misstatement as a violation of the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. That attempt should fail, as this court's cases recognize what we all know as a matter of common sense. There is a big difference between a judge actually relying on misinformation and a judge briefly misspeaking before accepting correction.
But how do we know for sure it was a misstatement? I mean, that's a pretty big, that's not 21 months versus 18 months. I mean, 4 years, maybe it was a misstatement, maybe it was a misapprehension of the facts.
A few ways, Your Honor. First, the sentencing judge accepted the undisputed correct facts in the pre-sentence report, which specifically stated that the offense went on for 18 months. So those are the facts that from the outset of the sentencing hearing define the crime and the sentencing. Second, if you read the sentencing transcript from front page to last page, what you'll see is that during the remarks of defense counsel and the defendant, they used the phrase 4 years five different times. Understandably, because they were talking about Mr. Varis's good conduct over the course of the 4 years that had elapsed since the government executed a search warrant at his home. But just as a matter of human nature, at least I know, I think we all know, that sometimes when you hear a number said over and over, when you go to say a number, accidentally the one you just heard comes out of your mouth. And that, I think, is just the fairest reading of the transcript here. And as soon as Mr. Varis's counsel corrected the district court accepted correction. Crucially, and contrary to what counsel has represented here today, that happened before the district court formally imposed Mr. Varis's sentence. What happened, if you look at the transcript, is this. The district court's initial sentencing remarks go from the appendix pages 29 to 33. His errors at page 31. On page 33, at the end of his remarks, the court did what it typically does, and it announced its intention to impose a sentence of 28 months, but it did not yet formally impose the sentence. On page 33, then, Mr. Varis immediately corrected the court. The court accepted correction. And on page 35, the court pronounced its judgment, beginning, quote, "This is the formal sentence of the court." So the distinction the counsel has drawn is simply inaccurate on the facts of this case. As to the second argument, Mr. Varis argues that the sentencing court failed to address his comparisons to other defendants. As an initial matter, the district court did address Mr. Varis's role, calling him the linchpin of this extensive scheme, which was the heart of counsel's argument about the comparisons with other defendants. But in any event, even aside from that, a long line of precedent from this court and the Supreme Court squarely forecloses Mr. Varis's argument on this score. As the Supreme Court put it in Gall, the sentencing judge, quote, "necessarily gave significant weight and consideration to the need to avoid unwarranted disparities," end quote, by correctly applying the guidelines. There is no exception to that rule for white-collar offenders whose guidelines are calculated based on Section 2B1.1 of the sentencing guidelines, and this court has applied that rule in the context of defendants who were sentenced based on Section 2B1.1. United States against Oliver, 873 F3rd 601.
Counsel, did the district judge accept the recommended sentence in the PSR, or did he go higher?
The guidelines range was 37 to 46 months. The district court imposed a 28-month sentence. I do not have access to what the probation agent actually recommended. That is sealed and neither party can see. Ultimately, both claims in this appeal boil down to the same thing. An effort to find any flaw in the sentencing transcript, however small, and to leverage that flaw into a second bite at the apple. You can see that particularly in the remedy requested here. Not just resentencing, but reassignment to a new judge. Mr. Varis does not argue that the alleged errors had a substantive effect on his sentence. His ultimate goal is not really a resentencing free of these alleged errors, but a chance to be sentenced by a different judge. Fortunately, there is no reason to remand this case at all, not to mention reassignment under Rule 36. The government respectfully requests that the decision below be affirmed. If there are no further questions, I will cede the rest of my time to the court. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a few brief points. Sure. Claiming that a judge who gets the length of your offense wildly wrong to the tune of 266%, claiming that noting that error is a quibble, I think, that's a bad call. I think any of us who were in that situation and would have that happen to us would feel that something had gone wrong in the sentencing process.
What were the other uses of 4 years? there were 4 years represented something else, at least in the context of this case, as I understood.
Yeah, so we talked about the four-year period about 15 minutes beforehand. So the suggestion that somehow mentioning that 15 minutes beforehand.
What was the four-year period?
Sure. What we were talking about was the length of time from the sentencing going back until when the offense had stopped. Okay. And it was a period of time where Mr. Varis had been obeying the law, had been, he had hired a lawyer, he had cooperated with the government, he had gotten a job, he had gotten married, he'd been living sort of a crime-free life. So that was one of the arguments we were making, Your Honor. But it happened about 15 minutes before the judge made his statement. And the record speaks for itself. He said what he said, and then when I brought up the actual period of time, he said, I stand corrected, and he had gotten it wrong. And with regard to when it happened, on page 33 of the appendix, before I can bring up the four-year comment, he says, the sentence that this court is going to impose is 28 months, followed by the statutory maximum 24 months, and then he even mentions the term of supervised release and talks about the supervised release terms. One final note is, that's kind of what the government is arguing. It has sort of been rejected in a case called Lupke, where a judge didn't allow for allocution until after he'd announced the sentence. And then he said, okay, I guess I should let you allocute. And then afterwards, he formally announced the sentence. And what this court said was, that's not sufficient. And that case side is just 495 F3rd 443. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is taken under advisement, and our last